this is your Polycast for Thursday, December 22nd, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, one of the Twin Cities men convicted of terrorism charges speaks. Six Twin Cities chiropractors are facing federal charges in an alleged insurance fraud scheme. Matt Sepik reports.
U.S. Attorney Andy Luger says the doctors took advantage of Minnesota's no-fault insurance law that requires personal injury protection for drivers. He says they submitted claims for chiropractic care for car crash victims that was unnecessary or never provided. Luger says the doctors paid kickbacks to so-called runners who allegedly recruited patients and staged phony accidents. Defense Attorney Peter Wald represents Dr. Adam Burke of Minneapolis and says his client will plead not guilty.
Chiropractor. He has a great team that works for him and provides services that he thinks are appropriate to his patients.
Burke and three other doctors were indicted, but two were charged by information, indicating a plea bargain is likely. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Minnesota Senate Republicans have tapped Cal Ludeman to again serve as Secretary of the Senate. Tim Pugmire reports.
Ludeman held the same position the last time Republicans controlled the state Senate from 2011 to 2013. Ludeman is a former state representative from Tracy and was a Republican candidate for governor in 1986 and for Congress in 1992. He also had stints as commissioner of both Human Services and Employee Relations during Governor Tim Pawlenty's administration. In a statement announcing the nomination, incoming Republican Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka praised Ludeman's experience and ability to hit the ground running. He said Ludeman is a trusted advisor who will manage the Senate's administrative functions with a steady hand. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A third well-known name has entered the race for mayor in Minneapolis. Tim Nelson has more.
State Representative Raymond Dean announced his run for the top job at City Hall on Facebook. He joins the race against incumbent Betsy Hodges, who announced last week she was running for a second term, and former law school professor and NAACP president Nikema Levy-Pounds. Dean is one of 15 DFL legislators who represent the city of Minneapolis. His district runs from the north side of the 35W I-94 Commons through downtown and North Minneapolis to the southeast corner of Robbinsdale. He's an architect by profession and was first elected to the House in 2012, taking Bobby Champion's seat when Champion moved to the Senate. Dean has been a regular presence at key city events, including the protests at the 4th Precinct after the police shooting of Jamar Clark last year. The mayor's seat and the entire 13-member Minneapolis City Council will be on the ballot in November. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A pollinator protection committee appointed by Governor Dayton meets for the first time today. Dan Gunderson reports.
The 15-member committee will advise the governor and state agencies on pollinator policy and programs. A wide range of interests are represented, but beekeeper Steve Ellis thinks the committee will find common ground.
We have to work together. Agriculture needs pollination, and pollinators need agriculture.
Minnesota Farm Bureau President Kevin Papp agrees protecting pollinators is important, but he also wants to protect farmers from new pesticide regulations.
What agriculture does not want to do is to put Minnesota on an island where we have additional regulations above and beyond what the states around us have.
The committee will begin by reviewing a new pollinator protection report from state agencies. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
A jury convicted Guled Omar of conspiring to kill people abroad for the Islamic State in Syria. Out of the nine young Twin Cities men who were sentenced last month, Omar received the harshest penalty, 35 years in prison. But in his first interview since his arrest last year, Omar tells NPR News that there's much more to him than that. Laura Ewan has the story.
Hello, this is a free call from...
That's Omar.
An inmate at...
Sherburne County Jail.
This call is...
Guled Omar just might be the most complex figure in Minnesota's ISIS radicalization case. And if you believe federal authorities, he's a dangerous stew of charisma and cunning. So it's not surprising when Omar sounds courteous and entirely at ease when he calls.
Good morning, Laura. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for calling me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you
Omar is 22, and for much of his life, his path was not unlike many of his Somali-American peers. He was born in a Kenyan refugee camp and came to the U.S. when he was a toddler. Omar grew up in a big family of 13 kids, raised by a single mom who fled Somalia's civil war. But Omar also says he suffered abuse as a child. It occurred over 2 years, starting when he was 9. A probation officer evaluating Omar's case before his sentencing confirmed in a court document that he had numerous dark, permanent welts across his back. Omar didn't want to talk about the nature of the abuse or who did it, but he says it made him want to bury his pain. He was a sophomore in high school in Minneapolis when he first tried marijuana.
I was scared. I was paranoid the first time I did smoke weed. But I also felt like very strong at the same time. I felt like a man.
It wasn't just the abuse that made him feel overwhelmed. He says the kids at school derided him and other Somalis, making fun of the way they dressed and smelled. Just a few years ago, Omar spoke to reporters after he and hundreds of other South High School students got into a food fight. He says it erupted over a student who dumped milk on a Somali-American girl. In this video from the Star Tribune, Omar and his friends say they felt targeted.
We're the minority here. We're the ones who are about 10, 15 students.
Being attacked.
Why are we being attacked?
The other student, who you can also hear in the video, happens to be Adnan Farah, another man charged with plotting with Omar to join ISIS. But the isolation Omar felt at school, he says he also felt within his own Somali community. That's because his older brother Ahmed was one of the first Minnesota men to leave for the Horn of Africa, allegedly to join al-Shabaab. At the time, the idea that Americans would join a ghastly terrorism group overseas known for its suicide bombings drew national headlines, and even some local Somalis began to blame one another. Omar says after his brother was labeled a terrorist, people at his family's mosque began to recoil.
If anything, I was shunned away from everybody else. People stayed away from me. People didn't want to be around me. I was only 13, 14 at that age. Nobody came to my family and counseled my mother or me or any of my brothers and sisters and talked to us about, you know, how to understand it or how to move on from it.
This is a common theme when you talk to Omar. He talks about the isolation and the hardship and admits he lost his way, but he's quick to suggest that others could have done more to help him. Omar eventually started getting high several times a week and dabbled in cocaine. But now he started to feel a new sensation. It was shame, like he wasn't a good Muslim. Researchers who've studied hate groups say people who are drawn to extremist movements commonly have suffered from abuse, followed by cycles of self-blame. But a more prevalent characteristic is empathy, identifying with the suffering of others. When Omar was in his late teens, he began to learn about the atrocities committed by the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. He says the plight of the Syrian people made him recall his own personal trauma.
You know, it takes me back to then, how helpless I felt, and makes me, you know, feel all those feelings all over again.
Omar says he also began to believe no one else seemed to care about the Syrian conflict. Elders at the mosque discouraged talk of political grievances, and it pushed his conversations with his friends underground. His group grew more confused and angry.
A lot of times what these propaganda videos chase after, they look for people who are in those kind of vulnerable stages who are asking themselves them questions, and they answer those questions for them.
Omar says he wasn't infatuated with beheadings. He empathized with the people who were hurt. But audio clips played at trial suggest Omar was willing to kill people who stood in his way. A friend deep into the conspiracy, who later started working as an FBI informant, captured Omar and his friends on tape. And Omar's own voice became his most damning enemy at his trial. In this piece of audio, Omar is in a car. He tells the informant he'd kill Turkish security guards once he arrived at the Syrian border.
Bro, once I'm there, I'm at the khana. This do or die, bro. I'm killing nigga, bro. Wallahi billahi inshallah, I'll kill him. If I'm in Turkey, wallahi, I'll kill them.
Omar insists it was meaningless banter among friends. Federal authorities, however, point out Omar repeatedly lied to his family and tried again and again to make his way to Syria. Evidence presented at trial show he brought friends into the conspiracy, gave them contacts they would need in Syria, and wanted to route ISIS fighters through Mexico and into the U.S. A prosecutor said at Omar's sentencing hearing that he was not redeemable. Quote, you can't fix deceitful and you can't fix Guled Omar. In the courtroom, Omar wept as he apologized for his mistakes. But U.S. District Judge Michael Davis told Omar he didn't buy any of it. And Davis said it was because Omar was so charismatic that the judge felt he had to lock him up for decades.
And does he have a point? I mean, should we trust what you're saying?
I can see where some of the lack of trust can come from, but I cannot see how that can account to taking away 35 years of someone's life. All in all, I've never hurt anybody. I've never killed anybody. I've never murdered anybody. But the way I was, you know, being talked to, that's how I was portrayed to be.
Omar says people should give him a chance. He says he now wants to steer other young men from making the same mistakes he did.
So that these people with good intentions don't have to think that, okay, in order for God to be pleased with me, do I have to go and join these people?
We need to be very careful to avoid the assumption that everyone can be de-radicalized.
Counterterrorism expert John Horgan of Georgia State University says the government should find a way to capture the contrition and disillusionment of extremists who've repented. But the question is an individual like Omar truly remorseful?
A key question that I would be curious about would be, well, where and when precisely did he have this change of heart? If it happened the night before sentencing, then, well, clearly that doesn't really speak to him being genuine.
For his part, Guled Omar says he's been reforming himself over the year and a half he's been in prison. Omar will likely be sent to a maximum security prison after the start of the year, and he's appealing his conviction. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.